You're up. So, Tom, good afternoon, and thank you for coming to talk to me on Radio Jackie.
Thank
I'm
you.
going to talk about rugby, because rugby is where I think your heart lies. You play rugby at Teddington School.
Yeah.
And now you've become the first black chairman of an international rugby body, which is an amazing achievement. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I'm very proud to be chair of the Rugby Football Union. So actually, the Rugby Football Union is the governing body for rugby in England, and it's one of the bigger sports bodies. And yes, I am the first black chair of the RFU, and not of any national sporting body, but I suppose of one of the major national sporting bodies. I'm very comfortable with it, actually. I love rugby. I love rugby people, and it's where I naturally belong. And if by being a chair of this body, it encourages more people to come into the game from diverse backgrounds, then I think that's a really good thing.
Well, that leads me into women's rugby.
Yeah.
Because you say that's really quite close to your heart.
Yeah, absolutely.
And my daughter-in-law, Katie Carr, mm-hmm. she was captain at St France's Rugby, rugby team in Crawley, rugby club in Crawley.
Oh, brilliant.
And she was a winger.
Yeah.
And she's only 5'2".
Yeah.
And I've seen her bring down my 6-foot son in the garden without any problems at all.
Yeah.
So you say, you know, bringing women's rugby into the forefront of rugby is close to your heart. So she asked a few questions about whether when you have an international game, the ladies' game is always after the men's game.
Mm.
And people then tend to leave the stadium. Is there going to be some way around this? She said to have the women's game like before, make it part of the ticket price to attract larger audiences to watch the women's game, which is actually really exciting.
Yeah, I think what you would have seen over the last, through the autumn period, is that the women's games, when the Red Roses, England's team, were playing, were just separate from the men's game. They were their own games, England versus New Zealand and so forth. I went to those matches, incredibly exciting matches. And you know, we had audiences in the ground of circa 10,000, and on TV we had audiences of 1 million. I mean, it's just getting huge now. Our ambition at the RFU is at some point over the next few years is to fill Twickenham for a women's game, not a women's game and a men's game, but just a women's international game, to have 82,000 people in Twickenham. And that's what we're working towards. It takes time, and you've got to get momentum and so forth, but the fans are starting to come to women's game, because it's actually a slightly different game. It's quite fast, it's very free flowing. It's a really exciting game to watch, and the atmosphere at women's games is really exciting as well.
Yeah, do you think getting more women's rugby played at school will be a good starting point? Because at the moment, there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of women playing rugby at school. It's women playing netball or rounders, and the boys play football and rugby.
Yeah.
How do you think you can get this going in schools? Obviously, you have an interest in Hammersmith School.
Yeah.
Is it something you could push in that direction?
I think it will become more popular in schools. Particularly, we are the RFU is currently bidding to host the 2025 Women's World Cup in England, and we are the preferred bidder for that now, so all being well, it should come here. And then you'll have all the top players, the top women's players from all over the world, coming to England, playing matches up and down the country. We'll host it all over the country, and off the back of that, I think you'll have a real strong legacy program where you'll see the sport being picked up in schools up and down the country. We have about 40,000 women players at the moment, and we'd like to get that up to about 100,000, so really significantly grow the number of women playing rugby.
That's brilliant. I suppose it leads me on to sort of the next bunch of questions about the rule changes that are coming into rugby. I think next year, aren't there? There are lots of changes coming through about, well, obviously there's a lot of concern about the contact, the danger of the contact, the head injuries with rugby. And these new rules seem to be coming in to maybe address that. So I was reading that clubs can decide like how many people are going to play. They can change the number of people in the team, the number of people in the scrum, the length of time they play. How is that going to work?
So we are very conscious of the need to be right on top of the issues around player welfare, and we take it very, very, very seriously. And what we're doing is really looking at the data, looking at the science, analysing what's actually happening. There's fascinating things that we're working on and that the sport is working on at the moment. There are the rule changes that we introduce, or World Rugby introduce, and then we roll down. There are things that we'll trial about the tackle height. You know, can you tackle at the shoulder? Do you tackle below the armpits? Do you tackle only at the waist? Or you try all those sorts of things. But also some really interesting things. For example, there are mouth guards now that have like tiny gyroscopes in them, and so that when there's a tackle or something, or when there's a collision, these mouth guards will measure the hit, how hard was the hit and what direction was it, and they transmit, they also have transmitters in them, they transmit the information, so all of that information is collected, so you can really analyse at a level of detail exactly what's going on. And then when you do make rule changes, you make them not just sort of anecdotally with people saying, well, I think we should do this, I think we should do that, but you're making the changes based on what the data is telling you. So rugby is really at the forefront of all of these issues around player welfare and head injuries and so forth. And the board, at the RFU board, we have a committee that is particularly focused on it. My three priorities, having come in as chair, are about winning welfare and women's rugby. And so welfare is absolutely important. The interesting thing about welfare is on the other side of it, rugby is really positive from a mental health point of view, as well as being positive from a fitness point of view. Getting people out there, you know, if I see people, whether they're playing touch rugby, non-contact, contact rugby, just running around with an oval ball, the sort of sports, the team spirit of rugby is really, really good from a mental health point of view.
Absolutely. I think all exercise is good from a mental health point of view. For me, if I'm feeling a bit low, there's nothing like putting my running shoes on and running 5K.
Absolutely.
Because I think when I run, and I think this rugby obviously is very much a sport where lots of people play together, there's camaraderie, there's gamesmanship and everything. So absolutely what you say is correct in every way. Again, moving on to the men's game a little bit, the men are getting bigger. The rugby players, their necks are getting thicker, they're getting stockier. Where is it that we're going to reach? I mean, it's in every sport. You look at athletes who are doing distance running, short distance, like sprinters. As we go on, their bodies are evolving to match their sport. And I'm wondering just how big rugby players are going to get to. Is that a sensible question? I look at them and think
it's interesting. I mean, so I was a winger when I was young and playing. My son is a winger. He plays. I must have been, what would I have been, maybe 11 stone, 10 stone when I was his sort of age. He is probably 15 stone and all muscle head to toe, and he's one of the medium-sized guys on the pitch. There are some really big guys. He's very strong. The other day, for no particular reason, he just picked me up and put me over his shoulder and started marching around the house. And I was saying, I'm the chairman of rugby, put me down. Eventually I had to call my wife and say, tell him to put
me
down.
Help, women, come and help me, that's what wives do.
So the men and women are fit and big, and they work a lot harder in the gyms and so forth. But the game is more skillful. They know how to manage themselves better than we did back in the day. They eat much more healthily than we did. They tend not to smoke in the way that people did then.
Or drink.
They don't have a pint of beer at half time and that sort of thing. So you know, life moves on, people change, and that sort of drives some of the rule changes as well. You're dealing with different different body shapes and strengths, and in different parts of the game. You know, the professional players are much bigger, more fitter and so forth than some of the community players and so forth. So it's an interesting time we're going through.
Yes, so I mean, there's always going to be this big gap between the professional players and the amateur players, and then you go from the thing where my boys played rugby at school. It was a difference in size of some of them. You'd have the under 15 team. I remember one month going out, and there was this lad, he was nearly 7 foot.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, if he brings down one of our little ones, he's going to do a lot of damage. And I remember sidling up to the coach on the sideline saying, how are you going to sort this out? And he said, he's a paper tiger. Don't worry, you only have to touch him, he'll fall over. It did concern me, obviously being a pharmacist, having a medical background, the sort of damage that could happen on it. Will there ever be in school rugby a weight limit or a size limit at a particular age group for safety?
I think it comes down more to technique. Just because someone is tall or big, if you tackle them in the right way, they'll come down. So what the coaches have to do is really train people at an early age how to play the game, the real techniques of how to play the game, how to tackle, how to engage and so forth. And if you get those right, then it becomes less of an issue. But if those aren't really trained properly and coached properly, and people are just relying purely on their physicality the opposing team don't know how to stop them, then you can get into trouble sometimes.
Okay, so moving on from there, we've got this new COVID variant, Omicron. How is Twickenham, for the any international company, going to cope with the new rules and regulations? There was talk that supporters weren't being asked for their COVID passes when they went into one of the last matches. How's that going to be tackled?
Yeah, we are really on top of that. We're very, very careful, both in the squad, when they're isolated and so forth. As we saw with the Autumn Internationals, none of the Autumn Internationals were called off as a result of COVID outbreaks amongst any of the teams. And you had occasional people who tested positive, but overall they were okay. And that was a testament to how tight the management was on that side of things. And then on the stadium side of things, we were very close to the government. We were very much following government guidance on how to handle the crowds at the stadiums and so forth. So it's something that we're going to have to keep staying on top of. I think COVID is with us now, it'll be with us for a while yet, and we're just going to have to really keep on top of it, keep following the rules, become smarter and smarter about how we handle it. But it'll impact all sports, and we'll do whatever we can to stay on top of it.
And will fans be checked when they come to stadium to see about their vaccination status? Is that something you're going to enforce? Because there are sort of rumours that not everybody was checked before.
It depends on what the government guidelines are. So if the government guidelines are that everyone needs to be checked, then everyone will be checked. If the government guidelines are that everyone should bring their proof of vaccination or negative tests, but not everyone needs to be checked, and then you do it by sampling, then that's the way it's done. So our team just stay very, very close to what the government tells us that we should be doing, and make sure that we follow those rules.
That's good. My son, who's another rugby fan, has said he read an interesting statistic the other day, that Fiji's only played 5 games since the last World Cup, and countries like England and Wales have played 22. And he was saying, how is the RFU going to work with other smaller countries around the world to bring more and more teams into maybe the Six Nations, or to create another competition where these smaller countries like Fiji can play more games on the international stage?
So the body that looks at rugby across the world is called World Rugby, and the RFU is England rugby, so our primary focus is rugby in England, and then we work with World Rugby, and World Rugby look across the world, so they look at the Pacific Island countries, they look at across the world at how they move the whole game forwards. And one of the things that you might have seen just recently actually was a change to the rules that will allow players who had previously played for another international team to, after a three-year cooling off period as it's called, to then go and play for another country that they have a link with. So for example, if someone who qualified for England but was from a Fiji or Tongan background played for England and then was no longer playing for England, once 3 years had passed, if they were selected, they could then go and play for Fiji or Tonga or wherever their links were there. And that's really positive, and you know, you'll see, I think, some really interesting players getting involved in those countries, and that will improve the quality of the game there and enable some really strong matches to take place. So I think that things are going on that will help. On the England side, we with Tonga, for example, we provided them with some good support on the coaching side and so forth, and it's really good on both sides. So from our point of view and our team, our match officials and our coaches and so forth, it gives them the opportunity to develop their skills by coaching another team and getting involved and so forth, and for the other team it helps improve their game as well. So we'll keep seeing rugby developing. The rugby community is a big community. It is constantly thinking about how to move the whole game forwards, and World Rugby has a watchful eye over everything to try and bring everyone along.
So could we be seeing in the future sort of changes? We obviously have the Rugby Sevens, which is fast seven-a-side rugby. So then you have the 15s. Do you think somewhere in between there'll be another level with a different number of players, with, as I say, slightly faster moving, somewhere in between the two, because they're quite different games?
Yeah. At the moment, 15s and 7s is sort of where things are. Some people have been looking at other formats. We always keep sort of open to, are there variations? Are there, for example, on the touch side, we introduced what's called touch union, which is a form of touch rugby, but also allows some kicking and so forth. So it just sort of changes the format a bit. So we're very aware of the need to keep rugby modern and keep it open and respond to what people are saying. But the core game that we play is 15s and 7s.
Yeah. And finally, with rugby, there's obviously a big financial shortfall because of coronavirus. How, obviously, as chairman, how do you think you're going to be able to tackle that going forward?
It has been a tough year because obviously our revenue is linked to matches being played and stadiums being full and broadcast revenue from games being on. And so 2020 it was a very tough year for us. A fair number of our costs are variable, so as the revenue came down, the costs came down as well, but there were also costs that people costs and overhead costs that we just had to bring down. So we had quite a few people that had to leave the organisation in order to reduce costs, which was very sad. But the game has emerged overall, and the RFU has emerged overall in fairly good shape. We have about 1,900 clubs across the country, and we didn't lose any clubs as a direct result of COVID. So with the support that the government provided and so forth, and the way the clubs were able to manage their finances and the support that the RFU was able to give them, the whole sort of club structure of rugby has emerged in quite okay shape. We now need to go through a period over the coming years of rebuilding again as the revenue starts to come in, and we really sort of get back to where we were.
Okay, I'm going to let you off rugby now, and I'm going to talk about similar, starting with the same R, Richmond.
Uh-huh.
So Richmond recently was announced to be the second happiest place to live in the UK,
yes.
And you're a happy person, and your mother was born in Richmond, mm-hmm. and you've now come back to live in Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
What about Richmond makes you happy?
We've been in and around Richmond for a long time. So my mother was born in Richmond, my grandparents grew up in Richmond, their grandparents came to Richmond. Originally, so I think with my children, that's five generations of our family within about a mile of where we are now. So even though I've lived abroad from time to time, we're Richmond people, and this is where we live. It's just got that sort of delightful countryside feel, but close to the city as well. You know, there you are in London in 12 or 15 minutes if you time it right at the station, and then here you are out at Richmond Park round the corner there, you know, watching the deer or walking down by the river. It's just got that delightful feel. It's always been a kind of a relaxed place in a way. I don't know whether it's attracted artistic people or creative people, but you always with me growing up and over the years, as you walk around, you see an actor here, you see a celebrity there. It's got that feel to it as well, which is really lovely.
I think, as you say, it's a park as well that's particularly lovely about Richmond.
Yeah,
I remember driving through one of the parks, and it was when it was in the rutting season for the deer.
Mm.
We were actually reporting and saying, you know, please, please be careful. And I saw a young couple with a child in a buggy and holding the hand, looking at the stag who was looking at a load of doe just behind him.
Yeah.
And I actually drove into the car park and legged it over to them and said, just really, really, really please be careful.
Yeah.
And then I saw somebody pointing a camera at me, and I said, why are you pointing a camera at me? He said, well, just, you know, he said, because they'd come up from, I think, Brighton or somewhere to watch the deer and watch their behaviour.
Yes.
And you said they are the most fascinating creatures.
Absolutely.
Well, that's it. Thank you so much for talking to me, Tom.
Oh, thank
it's been
you.
An absolute delight. And yes, I think you're a very happy person, and it comes out in your personality, and I'm sure it's driven your success, which has been immense.
Thank you very much.
So thank you for coming on to Radio Jackie to talk to me.
Thank you.